Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Chris Mim. He's the Managing Director of the Strategic Issues Team at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, better known as GAO. His overall mission is to improve the performance of the federal government. Chris, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, that's a big portfolio. Let me start with the basics. I'll bet that just about everyone who's listening to this has heard of the GAO, but I'd also bet that far fewer know exactly what it is and what it does. So let's start there. Just tell me a little bit about the agency you work for and the team that you head up.
The Government Accountability Office is an agent of the Congress, so we're in the legislative branch. We do work at the request of chairmen, ranking members of committees, and through written into legislation to do program evaluations and performance audits of the anywhere the federal money goes and anywhere the federal influence goes. And so we do about 1,000 different evaluations each year. The overwhelming majority of those are publicly available on our website, gao.gov, and it's quite an investment that the American people make in GAO, and so we want our information to be out there. We track very carefully that the results of our work, seeing if our recommendations are being implemented. We find they are being implemented, and we return a substantial financial advantage and non-financial accomplishments to the American people each year.
And your team is kind of the big picture team, right?
We have responsibility for a broad array of cross-cutting governance issues, including the nation's long-term fiscal challenges that we confront, intergovernmental relations, federal strategic planning, performance measurement, tax policy, regulation, and a number of other areas.
Well, I have several specific things about just those items that you mentioned regarding government that I wanted to ask you, but perhaps the biggest thing concerns the public trust in the government, or lack thereof. And so let me start there. As we've increasingly seen in media reports, the federal government has, to put it politely, a trust problem.
Right.
And there are lots of statistics out there, and I know that you're quite familiar with them, but let me just throw out a few to demonstrate this problem to our listeners. A recent New York Times CBS poll found that only 10% of the public trusted the government in Washington to do the right thing most or all of the time. Other recent similar polls with that question have put that number in the teens or the 20s, but no higher. The public thinks that on average, 53 cents of every tax dollar is wasted. When asked to invest power in the federal government or state and local government is preferred by about a 2-to-1 margin. And in a poll that we commissioned here at the Campbell Institute last year, only 21% of the public thought that the people working for the federal government are competent. Only 37% thought that in their interactions with federal workers they had been treated with respect, and only 22% said that they could trust individual federal civil servants to do what's right most of the time. So those are pretty scary numbers.
Absolutely.
All in all. And it's important to point out, though, that although these kinds of numbers are not new, they used to be much better. They seem to be getting worse. So first, what's going on here? Why the drop?
It's a very unhealthy development, and it's in a very worrisome one, because at some point, and don't know when that will be, but you have to worry of, do we hit a tipping point in which the federal government really can't recover from declines in citizen confidence? And then the questions of, that could have enormous implications for civic engagement, understandings of legitimacy at the federal level. Clearly some of it has to do with the current economic situation. But as you mentioned, it has been trending downward for a number of years, and even after the economy turns around, so we get back into the upper 20s, low 30s. That's still not a very healthy development. I think what's interesting here is the complexity of views that the American people have with government. Gary Wills wrote a book a number of years ago called A Necessary Evil, in which he kind of analyzed, and it's very common with it, you know, political scientists know this, you know, very, very well, that all the polls show that as citizens, we have a tendency to be philosophic conservatives and operational liberals. If we ask people exactly those types of questions of, you know, do you trust government, you know, and all the rest, the answers are generally quite pessimistic of, we want small government, or we want government off our backs, those types of things. When you start going down individual programs, though, individual programs have a tendency to get much higher support. There's the old saw of the politician that was told by the elderly person, keep government off of my Medicare, that sort of thing. And so we have very complex and in some cases uninformed views of what government does and how it produces things for us. And so it's, you know, disentangling all that and thinking about how we can therefore improve citizen confidence in government is an enormous challenge. Of the statistics that you laid out, you know, the one that is particularly disturbing for me is the citizens that said that they did not have a good interaction, were not treated with respect.
Right.
Because that's not something that you can just describe to larger political dynamics or the economies in the tank or something like that. That's something that we and my colleagues at the federal level and at all levels of government need to work on, because there is no excuse for people not having been treated with respect and dignity and, you know, by the people who they employ, which is what we are in government.
Well, you mentioned that some of this current dissatisfaction is coming from the economic situation. I also imagine that, of course, some of it is coming from perceptions of our current state of politics and our political institutions rather than our government, per se, or the federal bureaucracy. But what do you think government, that is the bureaucracy, can do to help counter those views? Is it fairly limited on what it can do to respond to this?
At the federal level, which is my primary, you know, lens in orientation, I think it is quite difficult because there's an awful lot of the politics which, as individual civil servants, don't control. There are things I think that we can do. You know, one is as we were discussing just a moment ago, is making sure that when we do have citizen interactions, that they are done that we are sensitive to the situation, that we are polite, that we are responsive, and all the rest. I think, you know, the second thing that we need to do, and this is a big initiative of this administration, and certainly the Congress has been pushing this as well, is to be more open to transparency into how government operates and to be actively seeking opportunities to expand civic engagement. And this administration has an open government initiative, and Congress has been pushing that with making sure that more information is available to citizens in close to real-time basis, and that they can use that information not just to have a lens into how government works, but also to create active opportunities to begin to influence that, either through using open dialogues, through the web, through facilitated meetings and the rest. I think that's very important, is to give citizens an understanding of you have an opportunity to influence. Obviously, the primary influence is through the election box, but you have an opportunity to influence the workings of government. That's much more difficult at a federal level. As you get down to state and even more so local level, where the services are actually delivered, that becomes even more important to make sure that citizens have those opportunities.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Chris Mim from the Government Accountability Office. Well, there's also a public concern about our long-term financial solvency, our deficits, our debt, and that's probably related to some of these newer trust numbers as well. It's also something that your team works on, increasing the understanding about the long-term fiscal challenges that the government faces. So I was curious in particular about how that effort has been affected by the political dynamics in the past couple of years, thinking in particular of the effects of the Tea Party movement. Has it been helped? Has it been hijacked? Something in between? What do you make of this?
Since we've been doing long-term budget simulations since the early 1990s to show the nation's long-term, meaning 20, 30, 40, up to 50 years out, budget prospects. And they've all shown a kind of a consistent, depressing approach to what the long term looks like. And it's driven primarily by demographics and rising health care costs. I think what has been very beneficial in recent years, and we certainly see it with what's going on in Washington, is a much greater attention and appreciation to how difficult the choices are that we need to make. Now, we in GAO, we're not a policy organization, and so for our responsibility is to provide Congress and elected decision makers with the information that can help them understand the trade-offs and ultimately citizens to understand the trade-offs. But the point that the hole that we're in financially from a fiscal standpoint going forward really underscores for us that we as citizens have some fundamental decisions that we need to make going forward about what size we want government to be, how we're going to fund it, who's going to, and basically what government's going to do. And these aren't things that can be dodged, or in the vernacular of the day, continuously kicking the can down the road, because eventually we're going to have to do this. And we saw it, you know, some of the challenges or political challenges of that with the debate over the summer about raising the debt ceiling and how difficult, and now we're seeing it with the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction. We're seeing how difficult those types of those discussions and debates really are. We're providing information to all of those efforts to help Congress and help the executive branch make those types of trade-offs and understand them. But they are some very, very difficult decisions that we as citizens need to make about what we want government to do and how we're willing to fund it.
Well, and this gets at one of the things that I puzzle over quite a bit, so I want you to help me puzzle it, is that on the one hand, you can look at the last couple of years and see what looks to be some pretty poisonous political climates out there. And I know that you are explicitly nonpartisan.
Right.
We'll get that out there. I'm not trying to push you in a partisan direction here. But on the one hand, it seems like there's this dysfunction now about having a serious conversation about this. On the other hand, it's really on the agenda. And so I wanted to see how do you see this in net terms, because there have been movements and people in the past, Ross Perot comes to mind, who have pushed the idea that we have got to get serious about where all this is going and how we're going to pay for it, but it always seems to fall back off the agenda. It's like it's everybody's second or third issue. Mm-hmm. Now all of a sudden it's a lot of people's first issue. So is this a good thing the last couple of years, or has it led to this kind of dysfunction in Congress where you just can't have a real conversation about it anymore?
I think it is a good thing, and I think we can have a real conversation, and the difficulties of the issues mean that the conversation is going to be a difficult conversation, and that there, and at times it won't be a pretty one. That's taking place. But there are some very fundamental questions that are going to have to be asked. I mean, the simulations that we show that we've been doing show if you wanted to take it all out of spending, that would probably get you to a reduced level of government that none of us as citizens would recognize what that government looks like. If you wanted to take it out of taxes, that would get you to only tax increases, that would get you a level of taxation that none of us would recognize. And so it's going to have to be eventually a mix of the two of those. How Congress and the American people eventually work their way through that, it will not be a pretty process. But the good thing is that it is on the agenda. Those types of decisions are being made.
Well, at GAO, you also oversee the accountability of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, the big stimulus package. So looking back a bit now, was that money carefully spent?
Our primary responsibility was to look at the money that was going through state and local governments. And so out of the currently estimated $860 billion package that was the Recovery Act, about $280 billion of that flowed through state and local governments. We had a very detailed and an extensive effort to look at that. The short answer of that is that we found that the Recovery Act money was very, very helpful to states in order to try and limit some of the really draconian cuts that they would have had to make either in medical care, education, infrastructure programs. There has not been widespread reports or findings of waste, fraud, and abuse, and I think an awful lot of the credit, the primary credit for that goes obviously to the people who are actually implementing the Recovery Act. They also had a separate governance structure called the Recovery and Transparency Board, the so-called RAT Board. I'm not sure whoever designed their name was a friend of the approach there. But the board, made up of inspectors generals across the government, led by Earl Devaney, was also very diligent in looking at how contracts were being let, grants, and all the rest. And so I think the American people, from the standpoint of, was the money well spent? Was it spent on its intended purposes? Was it spent with a minimal of, at least of at this point, of apparent waste, fraud, or abuse? They can feel good about that, at least to the $280 billion that has been flowing through states and local governments.
And then, of course, the broader question that's beyond your portfolio is, was it worth it in a broader sense? What impact did it have on the economy?
Well, the real risk there, or the big issue there, is that a number of analysts have shown that pretty much the state, the $280 billion just got you, that went through to the states, just got you back to what the status quo had been, because the states were and are still in a real big downsizing mode. So you didn't get that level of stimulative effect that perhaps had been hoped for.
And because, in large part, they can't run deficits the same way the federal government can.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to transition now to the topic of government performance. This is another big area of your concern and your agency's concern. What departments are particularly well-run and effective, would you say?
We have a project at the GAO that we've been doing since the early 1990s called the High Risk List, and that's to identify those programs and functions and operations that are most vulnerable to waste, fraud, abuse, and mismanagement, and or in need of fundamental transformation. There are currently 30 issues that are on our GAO High Risk List. It's not so much that any individual department is well run or poorly run, but segments within departments certainly are challenged or not challenged. I think one of the one of the agencies that is certainly, and the people there are the first to admit it and are working hard, that is still a work in progress, is the integration of the management functions within the Department of Homeland Security.
I was going to ask you about that.
That was an enormous challenge. I mean, in 2003, they took 22 different agencies, 180,000 different employees, bring them together in obviously dealing with an absolutely vital issue. Admiral Jim Loy, who was Commandant of the Coast Guard and then eventually a Deputy Secretary of the Department, had said several times, and it really resonated with me, he said, the challenge that people in Department of Homeland Security have is that they've got to get it right hundreds of thousands of times every day. The terrorists have to get it right one time, one day, and they win. And so given that that's the challenge, you're bringing together all these different departments with different cultures, different business operations, different perspectives on the world. That integration still remains very much a work in progress. We've with this last update of the high risk list, we also added oil and gas royalties over at Interior onto the high risk list. Obviously, there were some issues with Deepwater Horizon and the blow up down there. But it was also big questions as to whether or not the American people are getting the return on investment through these oil and gas leases, and they really don't have an awful lot of the capability within the department, and they're trying to build it in order to do that. Other areas that we look government wide, which is at high risk, is critical skills gaps. We see it. A number of agencies just don't have the people with the right skills in the right place in order to effectively carry out their mission. A number of the business operations within the Department of Defense, of contracting, of financial management, information technology, are still require an awful lot of work. And so there's all agencies have some things in which they're going well, and then a lot of agencies have some really longstanding issues that they need to continue to address.
In case you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and my guest is Chris Mim from the Government Accountability Office. Well, let me turn that around really quickly, briefly on this one, too. Is there one department or agency that is particularly well-run, that's sort of on your all-star list, or here's the model kind of thing?
There's a number of agencies which, kind of consistently that I, when I'm looking for a good or successful practice that I can have a tendency to turn to. And you have to realize as an auditor and an analyst, I'm structurally incapable of saying that something's really going well, and so I have to caveat everything. But I think Centers for Disease Control, we've been fairly impressed, or I've been impressed when, we've gone down and doing work on them. National Highway Traffic Safety Administration within the within Department of Transportation. The National Science Foundation has also been pretty good. And what I say, and I don't mean to be guarded on this, I said that I think the thing that binds them together, the commonality that they have, is that those are all three agencies, and there are others around government that as part of their basic way of doing business, is that they think broadly. They think outside the four walls of their agency, and they understand if we are going to be successful in our mission, we need to be touching others and dealing with them and making sure that they're actively involved. That's part of the story, by the way, of the turnaround with FEMA after Katrina. I mean, the Irene response was a completely different and more successful, completely different hurricanes, of course, but a completely different and more successful approach, in part because FEMA understood we need to be working with others, we need to pre-position our assets, we need to understand much broadly who else is going to be involved in making sure that we're successful here. So the successful agencies are those that are capable and comfortable in thinking across their organizational boundaries.
Well, your entire career has been in public service, and we have lots of students at this school who are considering a public service career, but they see, like others, the low esteem in which the public holds government and government workers, and the pressures now to limit their pay and benefits. So briefly, what do you say to them at this point as they're contemplating a career path?
Well, first, I as a citizen, I say thank you, because, I mean, this is, in my view, the most exciting, important, and challenging time to be involved in the wider public service and wider public administration. I'm a little bit envious of the they're coming out at exactly the time when it's really going to be very fun, which is going to be extremely challenging, but also an awful lot of fun here. Because of all the issues that we've been talking about, the nature of the long-term issues and how we have to rethink what we want government to do, the nature of some of the difficult management challenges that agencies face, the cross-cutting types of problems that we look for government to address, and therefore the variety of actors that need to be involved, and the whole focus on third-party government, the variety of actors that need to be involved in solving public solutions, really creates a very exciting and a great opportunity for people to be involved in the public sector.
And now the three questions. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
I think it goes right back to the excitement point that we were just discussing, is that the chapter of the life I'd say I'm living is looking for the connections.
Second, what's your worst trait?
Worst trait, she said, it's one of those things that I'm a little bit reluctant because if, as colleagues will hear this, they'll either say, well, yeah, he's absolutely right, we'd agree, or say, no, we can name five or six others in which he's much worse than that. Quite honestly, I'd have to say follow through. I like big ideas. I like working on things. I need people around me that take those ideas and help keep me on task and say, okay, here's our next step. Here's our implementation plan.
And finally, what achievement in your creative or professional life so far has surprised you the most?
The need for us as analysts to be able to have methodologies that mirror the complexity of the programs that we're actually analyzing and how difficult that is to do. That's still a work in progress for us that, and it's not something that I've been able to do yet, is that, we understand conceptually that all these issues are connected and how difficult they are. We need to get audit evaluation tools that mirror that or that understand that so that we can provide valuable information to the Congress.
That was Chris Mim. Chris, thanks so much for talking with me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
Support for the Campbell Conversations comes from the Campbell Public Affairs Institute, hosting a public lecture titled Cooperating for the Public Good by Economics Nobel Prize winner Eleanor Ostrom, Friday, January 27th at 4 in the Maxwell School Auditorium on the SU campus. Information at campbellinstitute.org. The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher. Associate producers include Bethany Wallowender and Kelly Coleman, with recording engineer Tom Fazio. Learn more about the Campbell Conversations by visiting our website, wrvo.fm.